Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
An increasing number of North Koreans who fled their country have become involved in politics in South Korea. For the first time, two North Korean defectors are running for office in South Korea's legislative elections. The two hope to improve conditions for defectors and to change the way South Koreans think of the North. The elections will be held on April 15th. About 200 North Korean defectors recently met in Seoul. They sang songs about the future unification of North and South Korea. They are trying to form the first South Korean political party made up completely of North Korean defectors. Kang Chol-hwan is assisting in setting up the political party. He said, "No one represents the people of North Korea." It is estimated that there are about 35,000 defectors in South Korea. Kang said he believes that they are neglected. Those feelings could change if they get political representation in the National Assembly. The two North Korean defectors who are seeking office are running as members of conservative opposition parties. Ji Song-ho is one of those defectors. He lost an arm and a leg as a teenager in an accident on a coal train. Ji fled to the South in 2006. He appeared as a guest of American President Donald Trump at the State of the Union speech in early 2018 in Washington, D.C. He is now a human rights activist. Ji said he belongs to the younger generation. He decided he should run for office after South Korea returned two North Korean fishermen in November. South Korean officials accused the two of killing their captain and 15 other crewmen. Many defectors said the move was the same as giving the men a death sentence. The same incident motivated Tae Yong-ho to enter politics. Tae is a former North Korean diplomat to London. He is one of the highest-level defectors to come to the South in many years. Tae recently spoke to foreign reporters in Seoul. "I want to show to the North Korean people how freedom and democracy works in this country," he said. Tae has been very critical of North Korea since he moved to the South in 2016. More recently, he also has begun criticizing the South Korean government. He wants better treatment for defectors, many of whom feel discriminated against. The former North Koreans also are among the poorest groups in South Korea. Defectors are required to get 3 months of training to learn how to live on their own in a capitalist country like South Korea. But many do not get enough help. In July, a North Korean defector and her 6-year-old son were found dead in their apartment. They had apparently starved to death. The government said recently that the average defector's monthly earnings had reached its highest level ever. But many say it is still not enough. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Students who are worried about climate change want universities to cut investments in energy companies that deal in fossil fuels. The effort is gaining attention at well-known schools like Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., Harvard University in Massachusetts, and Yale University in Connecticut. The effort began nearly 10 years ago. Student activists increasingly have learned methods from each other on how to act to push for changes. They also have grown increasingly concerned as predictions of the effects of climate change become more troubling. Georgetown University's Board of Directors announced this month that it will end its investments in coal, oil, and gas companies within 10 years. Some professors at Harvard have called for similar measures. In recent weeks, demonstrations were held at several schools, including Gonzaga University in Washington State, the University of Wisconsin, the University of Pittsburgh, and Cornell University in New York State. Some schools have stopped investing in energy companies. However, critics question whether such actions slow the effects of climate change or hurt the profits of energy companies. Many schools defend their investments. They say they have a responsibility to grow the money they receive from donations. They also say it is easier to affect change as an investor, so they can help change company policies or find answers to climate problems through research. For student activists, however, it is about taking a moral and political position. Yale University, for example, has an endowment valued at $30.3 billion. An endowment is money that was donated to support a university and that is invested to grow and support future goals. Recently, some Yale professors agreed to discuss the university's moral obligations related to fossil fuels. The issue got attention when student protests interrupted the yearly Harvard and Yale football game. "Yale has to take it seriously. We forced them to take it seriously," said Ben Levin. He is a student leader with the Yale Endowment Justice Coalition. Yale said it has supported shareholder proposals that companies report on what they are doing to fight climate change. Yale has asked supervisors of its investments not to invest in companies that do not work to reduce gas emissions. But student activists want a clean break. The actions are part of a larger movement to get insurance companies, large investors, and governments to end fossil fuel investments. Environmentalist and writer Bill McKibben is a leader of the movement to stop investments in fossil fuels. He said students have played an important part because they keep pressure on university officials. McKibben is a professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. The school announced last year that it would sell all its investments related to fossil fuel companies. The Independent Petroleum Association of America has answered with its own campaign. It argues that pulling back from fossil fuel-related investments will be very costly for universities, and it will do little to affect climate change. I'm Susan Shand.
New parents who clean their homes very often to protect their babies from bacteria and other organisms might want to cut back their efforts. A new study suggests that high levels of contact with cleaning products are linked to an increased risk of the childhood breathing condition known as asthma. Researchers asked a group of parents how often they used 26 common household cleaners during their baby's first 3 to 4 months of life. By age 3, the children who had come in contact with cleaning products the most were more likely to be diagnosed with asthma. The researchers said that children who had a lot of contact with cleaners were 37% more likely to have asthma than children with the least contact. The study also found that a lot of exposure to cleaning products caused children to be 35% more likely to have chronic difficulty breathing. In addition, they were 49% more likely to have chronic allergies. Tim Takaro, who helped lead the study, is a doctor with Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. He told the Reuters News Service he understands that parents want to make their homes safe for their children. But he suggests that they should question the belief that their home is clean only if it smells like chemical-based cleaning products. Instead, we propose that the smell of a healthy home is no smell at all, said Takaro. Takaro said parents should read labels and look for products that are free of substances like chemical colors and smells. Also, they should consider natural cleaning products instead of chemical ones. The study appeared in the medical publication CMAJ earlier this month. The researchers wrote that the first months of life are very important for development of the body's natural defenses, known as the immune system. The same is true for the organs involved in breathing. Chemicals in cleaning products can cause chronic inflammation that may lead to asthma. It also may make symptoms appear more often and intensely, the researchers noted. Asthma can be difficult to diagnose with breathing tests involving young children. So researchers also tested the children's skin for allergies and asked parents how often children experienced symptoms like trouble breathing. The most commonly used cleaning products in the study were dishwashing soap, multipurpose cleaners, glass cleaners, and soap for washing clothes. The American Lung Association recommends avoiding cleaning products that contain volatile organic substances and other irritants. But companies in Canada and the United States are not required to list all the chemicals in cleaning products. Some products labeled as environmentally friendly or green may contain harmful substances. Alyssa Abrams, who wrote comments on the study, is a doctor with the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. She admitted that the effects of cleaning products are not well understood, but she believes these products and the chemicals they contain act as irritants to growing children. Young children who spend a lot of time indoors may be at greater risk, said Abrams. The take-home message is that parents should be careful which cleaning products they use in the home, she added. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The election of Herbert Hoover in 1928 made Americans more hopeful than ever about their future. Hoover seemed to have just the right experience to lead the nation to more economic progress. He was an engineer and businessman who had served in the government as Commerce Secretary. He understood economics and had faith in the future of private business. On a rainy day in March of 1929, Hoover rode down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington to become the new president. "I have no fears for the future of our country," he told the cheering crowd. "It is bright with hope." Faith Lapidus and Bob Doty tell more about the Republican administration of Herbert Hoover.
The clearest evidence of the public's faith in the economy is the stock market. And the New York Stock Exchange reacted to the new president with a wild increase in prices. During the months after Hoover's election, prices generally rose like a rocket. Stocks valued at $100 climbed to $200, then $300, $400. Men and women made huge amounts of money overnight. Publications and economic experts advised Americans to buy stocks before prices went even higher. Time and again, people heard how rich they could become if they found and bought stocks for companies growing into industrial giants. "Never sell the United States short," said one publication. Another just said, "Everybody ought to be rich."
A number of economic experts worried about the sharp increase in stock prices that followed Hoover's election. The president himself urged stock market officials to make trading more honest and safe. And he approved a move by the Federal Reserve Board to increase the interest charged to banks. However, both efforts failed to stop the growing number of Americans who were spending their money wildly on stocks. Some experts pointed to danger signs in the economy during the summer of 1929. The number of houses being built was dropping. Industries were reducing the amount of products that they held in their factories. The rate of growth in spending by average Americans was falling sharply. And industrial production, employment, and prices were down. These experts warned that the American economy was just not strong enough to support such rapid growth in stock prices. They said there was no real value behind many of the high prices. They said a stock price could not increase 4 times while a company's sales stayed the same. They said the high prices were built on foolish dreams of wealth, not real value.
But the prices went still higher. Buyers fought with each other to pay more and more for company stocks. The average price of all stocks almost doubled in just 1 year. It seemed everybody was buying stocks, even people with little money or economic training. A clothing salesman got advice from a stock trader visiting his store and made $200,000. A nurse learned of a good company from someone in the hospital. She made $30,000. There were thousands of such stories. By early September, the stock market reached its high point of the past 18 months. Shares of the Westinghouse Company had climbed from $91 to $313. The Anaconda Copper Company had risen from $54 to $162. Union Carbide jumped from $145 to $413. Life was like a dream, but like any dream, it could not last forever.
In September 1929, stock prices stopped rising. During the next month and a half, stock prices fell, but only slowly. Then, suddenly, at the end of October, the market crashed. Prices dropped wildly. Leading stocks fell $5, $10, $20 in a single day. Everyone tried to sell their stocks, but no one was buying. Fear washed across the stock market. People were losing money even faster than they had made it.
The stock market collapsed on Thursday, October 24th, 1929. People remember the day as Black Thursday, the day the dreams ended. The day began with a wave of selling. People from across the country sent messages to their stock traders in New York. All the messages said the same thing. Sell! Sell the stocks at any price possible! But no one was buying. And so down the prices came. The value of stock for the Montgomery Ward store dropped from $83 to $50 in a single day. The RCA Radio Corporation fell from $68 to $44, down $24 in just a few hours. Down the stocks fell, lower and lower. Several of the country's leading bankers met to discuss ways to stop the disaster. They agreed to buy stocks in large amounts to stop the wave of selling. The bankers moved quickly, and for 2 days, prices held steady. But then, like snow falling down the side of a mountain, the stocks dropped again. Prices went to amazingly low levels. One business newspaper said simply, "The present week has witnessed the greatest stock market disaster of all time."
The stock market crash ruined thousands of Americans. In a few short weeks, traders lost $30 billion, an amount almost as great as all the money the United States had spent in World War I. Some businessmen could not accept what had happened. They jumped from the tops of buildings and killed themselves. In fact, one popular joke of the time said that hotel owners had to ask people if they wanted rooms for sleeping or jumping. But the stock market crash was nothing to laugh about. It destroyed much of the money that Americans had saved. Even worse, it caused millions of people to worry and lose faith in the economy. They were not sure what to expect tomorrow. Business owners would not spend money for new factories or business operations. Instead, they decided to wait and see what would happen. This reduced production and caused more workers to lose their jobs. Fewer workers meant fewer people with money to buy goods. And fewer people buying goods meant less need for factories to produce. So it went. In short, economic disaster.
Why did the stock market crash? One reason, people had been paying too much for stocks. Everyone believed that prices would go higher and higher forever. People paid more for stocks than the stocks were worth. They hoped to sell the stocks at even higher prices. It was like a children's balloon that expands with air, blowing bigger and bigger until it bursts. But there were other important reasons. Industrial profits were too high and wages too low. 5% of the population owned one-third of all personal income. The average worker simply did not have enough money to buy enough of all the new goods that factories were producing. Another problem was that companies were not investing enough money in new factories and supplies. There were also problems with the rules of the stock market itself. People were allowed to buy stocks when they did not have the money to do so.
Several government economic policies also helped cause the stock market crash of 1929. Government tax policies made the rich richer and the poor poorer. And the government did little to control the national money supply, even when the economy faced disaster. The stock market crash marked the beginning of the Great Depression, a long, slow, painful fall to the worst economic crisis in American history. The Depression would bring suffering to millions of people. It would cause major political changes, and it would be a major force in creating the conditions that led to World War II.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.